Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Seriously, the podcast from The New Statesman that takes pop culture seriously.
I'm Caroline Crampton.
And I'm Anna Leskovich. This week we're talking about the BBC drama A Very English Scandal and the film On Chesil Beach.
Anna has also watched the 2001 rom-com Kate and Leopold for the first time, so we'll be hearing about how that went later in the show.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Seriously. Thanks so much, listeners, for bearing with me as I took a week off last week. I'm feeling a lot better, so we're ready to roll again. But Caroline very handily did a kind of listener survey question last week, which a lot of people got back to.
Yeah, lots and lots of you got in touch to give us your thoughts and tell us how you're enjoying the show or not enjoying it. I would like
Everyone hated it.
I would like to personally congratulate the person who said that their biggest problem with the show was that the books we read are too, quote, female-centric. That was a highlight.
Oh, go away. Sorry for that one listener, but no.
But no, people were overwhelmingly helpful and constructive, and there's lots of things from what you said that we want to implement. If you still want to have your say, the survey's still running, so you can get to it at seriouslypod.com/survey. It only takes a couple of minutes. Loads of the questions are optional, so you can just click boxes and tell us what you like.
Amazing. Thanks for sorting it, Caroline. So I'm feeling a little tired today. Last night I went to see Arctic Monkeys at the Royal Albert Hall in London, which was just an amazing gig. I was kind of worried that it wouldn't be worth it because this is a very kind of privileged wine, but I couldn't get a press ticket. And it's a charity gig, so you can't be too gross about not getting a free press ticket to an expensive charity gig, obviously. That's just gross and lame. But I was like, should I buy tickets? And it was really hard to get tickets and they all sold out super quickly. So I managed to get one ticket and I was like, ooh, do I go on my own? Like, I knew loads of people going, but do I have to say goodbye to them and go and stand on my own to see Arctic Monkeys? Isn't that just going to be a bit sad and depressing? So I wasn't sure. When I got there, I was like, I don't know if this was worth it. I was like sat in a box behind these two guys who were like, absolutely raring to go, like just necking back the pints, these two lads just going for it, you know, really shouting and whatever. And I was like, oh god, this is going to be awful. And then it was actually amazing. It was so great. We were sharing a box, me and these guys became best of friends, were like right hanging out of the front of our bloody box, amazing view, and it was just great. I was also kind of nervous because we talked about how much more relaxed and loungy and louche this new Arctic Monkeys record is, and especially because the gig was in the Royal Albert Hall, I thought like, oh, is this going to be a bit of a sit down affair? Are they not really going to go back to their old, more, you know, furious music? But really most of it was old stuff, though they only played 4 tracks off the new record out of like 20 songs that they played. And it was just like amazing. They played From the Ritz to the Rubble, which they haven't played since 2011 or something. They literally haven't done it live in about 7 years, and people were going mental. Like, I was genuinely worried for some people's safety hanging out of those boxes. Like, it was incredible. Even if Alex Turner's kind of deliberately embarrassing persona kind of cast a long shadow over some of the rock songs, because they do seem a little bit more pathetic when he's doing this whole aging rock star thing. But yeah, I loved it. I thought it was amazing. So that's been my interesting news this week.
That in a way makes me a bit sad, because I was vaguely looking at like Will the Arctic Monkeys tour in the hope that it would just be a playthrough of the new album, because I am obsessed with Tranquility Hotel Base and Casino.
I'm completely Space, Hotel and Casino? Base? Is it Base?
I can't get the words in the right order, but yeah, it's those four words in some order. But yeah. I'm completely obsessed with it. I listen to it at least 3 times a day, and I would happily sit in a venue and listen to them just like play it through as a piece of music, the whole album.
Well, you might still be in luck, because that was a kind of one-off gig. Like, it's not really, I don't know if it's going to be the same set list for their tour. I wondered if it was maybe a bit of a homecoming gig for them, because they haven't played in the UK for about 4 years. And so whether because of that, they wanted to just like do a big kind of, you know, almost festival
like. Sort of like best of set, yeah.
But I don't know, it could be the exact same set on their tour, we'll have to see.
Well, I imagine I'm in a very small minority at wanting
that. I think
that.
So, yeah.
So it might be that actually they are doing the commercially sensible thing and playing all of their old hits so that people will actually buy tickets. Yeah, you know how, I mean, I don't really go to gigs very much anymore, but I had a period when I was like 17, 18 when I went to a lot. And yeah, it was always so annoying when you went to a Strokes gig or something and they played like 6 songs in a row from the new album that you'd barely listened to. So it was just like this boring intermission amidst all of the like awesome dancing you were doing to all of the other stuff.
Totally. No, it definitely wasn't like that at all. I mean, the moments where they played some of the new songs, you did kind of get like a little like someone turned to me and was like, so what do you think of the new album?
Right.
So that it was kind of a moment for people to kind of like shrug and stuff. But yeah, also like one of the songs they played last night from the new album, Star Treatment, it was like the first time they'd ever played it live, and people were really into it. Like there was a little cheer when he said, I've played quiet rooms like this before, you know, people kind of being like, no, we love it. But it felt like the loyalty of very keen, you know, obsessive fans, not the genuine kind of just like sheer joy that they then showed later when some of the old hits started being played. So slightly, I don't know, people like went mental for things like Brian Storm. Those were still clearly the fan favorites. So the first thing that we're going to talk about this week is A Very English Scandal, a BBC drama adapted by Russell T Davies from John Preston's book of the same name. It depicts the relationship between and subsequent scandal surrounding the British Liberal MP Jeremy Thorpe, here played by Hugh Grant, and his lover Norman Scott, played by Ben Whishaw. It's set in the late 1960s when homosexuality has only just been decriminalised. And I think there are some bits right at the beginning actually pre-homosexuality being decriminalised, which really makes it hit home, you know, what a totally different context this crime is happening in compared to, you know, now. Yeah, so it's in 3 parts, and from the off, what I love about this is that it didn't try to avoid being camp.
Yes, I was really surprised by that. I was expecting, because it's a very serious and quite tragic story, you know, it's a real life story, so I don't think, and it's very, very well known in Britain, so I don't think it's a spoiler to say that just what happens is this MP is having gay relationships. Even though it's only just been decriminalised, it's a social taboo still. He wants to be prime minister one day, and he gets to a point where he thinks that the only way he can still realise his political ambitions is if he has his former lover killed, so that he can't reveal what happens between them. If this all spirals out of control and it ends up in this massive trial from which he's then acquitted, but his political career is essentially over. It's a really, really serious, tragic story. And I was so surprised when the credits for the first episode started, and they were very deliberately, like, in the style of television of the period, really jaunty music, lots of... You know, Hugh Grant, I think, does a good job in this as Jeremy Thorpe of showing all the different facets of him, but he definitely has a kind of winky, slightly leery side to him, which I wasn't prepared for at all. So yeah, that really took me aback.
Yeah, I think Hugh Grant's performance in this is just absolutely amazing. He's so deliberately villainous and camp, and he's very, very charismatic the whole time, which, you know, one thing I also liked about this is that it doesn't actually encourage you to take sides. Like, obviously, we can all see that Jeremy Thorpe is the villain of this piece. You know, that's clear, but it also encourages us to recontextualize and understand the, you know, intense internalized homophobia that might, you know, it's not even internalized homophobia, I guess it's just like fear of being judged and shame that surrounds something like this. So there's really no cartoonish villains. And I say that knowing that Hugh Grant actually does give the performance really of a cartoonish villain, but in the context of how the drama functions, there are often moments where you're encouraged to root for that cartoonish villain. So it's not like a retrial of anyone.
I also think Thorpe himself was a bit like that, you know, from what I've read and seen of the man himself. He definitely had a kind of, oh, I'm the big old baddie, ha ha ha. Like that was something he did lean into. So I don't think it's a sort of extrapolation on Grant's part. Incidentally, I wanted to ask you, what is the name for this phase in Hugh Grant's career? Because we had the reconnaissance when Matthew McConaughey suddenly became someone who did serious acting. I feel like Hugh Grant, as has been said in a number of think pieces around the release of this piece, Hugh Grant has finally come out of rom-com jail and is now, quote, a proper actor again. What are we calling it?
Well, it's funny, actually, because I kind of see it in those terms, you're right, but also in opposite terms, in that this isn't a move from camp to serious. It's really a move from serious to camp. In that he's now doing a lot more. You know, he's done kids movies. He's doing TV.
He's in Florence Foster Jenkins.
He's in these, very, very silly comedies, not, you know, dramatic comedies, but comedies. And he's doing these performances that are the opposite, really, of a romantic lead. So it's really interesting. I've been calling it late stage Hugh Grant, but yes. I'll take anything, really.
The best I could come up with was Hugh Grant goes dark or something like that, you know, Hugh Grant's dark side.
But I have to say, I find this narrative interesting of like Hugh Grant moves from rom-coms to villains, because in a sense that is what is happening. But also at the very beginning of Hugh Grant's career, he was typecast as a villain pre-Four Weddings. I mean, no one really has any kind of conception of pre-Four Weddings Hugh Grant. But if you go through his credits, that was his vibe. And he has talked in early interviews, you see him talking a lot about, oh yeah, I was typecast as this villain. And I think he's always been good at bringing that villainous edge. And I think that's partly what made him successful in rom-coms, is the potential, you know, when a misunderstanding happens, there's a side to him where you know, the wronged romantic lead woman is like, oh wait, he was just a playboy all along. And then obviously in Bridget Jones, he's really good at being the charismatic but like villainous playboy.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, I think you could advance a theory that in the Me Too era, was not Hugh Grant a villain all along? Was he not, you know, gaslighting women left, right and centre as they tried to just date him?
That is the perfect piece. Yeah, come on, Caroline, get that one down. So yeah, he's just a delight, an absolute delight to watch in this. And the whole thing has been made with that mischievous spirit in mind, I think. And it is very Russell T. Davis.
Yes, so much.
One thing that really interested me, which was something that was lingering in the back of my mind when I was watching it, was the portrayal of Norman Scott by Ben Whishaw, who plays this, he plays it very fey and very, you know, he's quite effeminate and very, very camp in a different way in this role. And he's much more vulnerable and like visibly vulnerable. And there's something about him that's like, he's both very cute in this, and there's also something like almost repulsive about him. I think he's deliberately framed as kind of so needy and vulnerable that you're a bit like, oh, I struggle with this character. And he becomes a punchline a lot. And a writer that I really like, Alim Kiraj, wrote in the Independent a think piece basically saying, like, why are camp men always the butt of the joke? Even in a show like this that's very revisionist and accepting and, you know, rethinking a lot of our ideas about homosexuality and masculinity and stuff, even here, a lot of the time the butt of the joke is like Ben Whishaw in a silly coat. It's just a really interesting perspective. And so I would recommend reading that, and we'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, that's very true. There's that whole sequence in the first episode when he first starts modelling when he's living in Dublin. And an awful lot of it is just like, oh, look at Ben Whishaw, isn't he such a stereotypical gay? He's like, where he's got his chest out, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, he's got a kind of fag hag best friend now and all of that. Yeah, and I know what you mean. It's very, very skillful acting on Whishaw's part, because I found myself veering wildly between thinking, you know, Jeremy Thorpe was so horrible to this man. Like, he just wanted to be in a like loving relationship with him, and he wanted to be codependent and spend time with you, and you just left him alone all the time and like never spoke to him but still wanted to have sex with him. But then I would also, when Whishaw would like dial up the kind of, but where's my national insurance card type stuff, I would think, no, actually, this is quite destructive behavior. I can see why this was really difficult.
Yeah, it's true. And I've always been really drawn to performances like those. We've joked a lot on this program about, I'm but a child in these matters from Bleak House. And it's the same thing with these like catchphrases, and it is camp and it is overblown. And there is some humor in that. And I think I will always find that kind of thing funny, but there's something dark lingering behind the laughs, isn't there? And this line from Alim in his piece, he's like, for the people who live their lives eschewing traditional masculinity and for whom campness isn't a humorous affectation, the fetishization by comedy of their behaviors, style or speech ultimately diminishes their experiences as a human being. Which is like, wow, what a line. That's it just makes you totally reconsider. So there's a lot going on in this program. We've talked about it quite seriously, but it is also just a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun. And it's so refreshing to see something that is getting the full heft of like the BBC drama thing, you know, a writer like Russell T Davies, it's directed by Stephen Frears. It's obviously a very expensive production because lots of it is filmed on location in the House of Commons and other places like that. And yet for what they've turned out isn't a kind of 19th century period drama about Gladstone or something. It's this thing that shades between comedy and drama. It focuses on gay relationships and it's trying to be funny.
Absolutely.
It's really refreshing.
Absolutely.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Now we're going to talk about On Chesil Beach, a film based on Ian McEwan's novella of the same name. It follows two young people on their wedding night trip to Chesil Beach in Dorset and tells the story of their relationship through flashbacks. In this adaptation, which was written by McEwan and directed by Dominic Cook, Florence is played by Saoirse Ronan and Edward by Billy Howell. So, Anna, did you read this when the book came out, I think in about 2007?
Sounds right. I was like a late teens, I think, when I read the book.
Yeah, I just remember, because I worked in a bookshop at the time, and I remember it being like a huge controversial topic of conversation amongst colleagues because it got nominated and indeed, I think, shortlisted for the Booker Prize that year.
Right, and it was so slim.
But it was so short. Mm. It was like 40,000 words or something. And so there was all of, in the bookshop I worked in, because we had like a Booker table display, there were some people like, we shouldn't even put it on the table. It's not a novel, it's a prize for novels.
That's funny. That's so silly.
So I just remember that being my introduction to the book, being like booksellers' feelings about its
length. Petty, rages.
Yeah, it is short. Because it is a very simple story. And it's got, I think, something that McEwan does in a lot of his novels, Atonement, Enduring Love, Saturday, all of them have this. It has one pivotal moment around which the whole rest of the story revolves. In Atonement, you know, it's the scene in the library that everybody's seen, Keira Knightley spread eagle against the book against the bookshelf. In this one, it's the wedding night, and it's the fact that these two young people, neither of whom really know anything about the physical realities of sex, attempt to have sex on their wedding night. It's a really horrible experience, and just everything falls apart.
Yeah.
In the book, it's very, very clever the way that that one moment keeps coming back and everything else is sort of seen in relation to it. And you can do that in a book. You know, you can sum up the rest of somebody's life in five pages and it doesn't seem weird. Whereas I think in a film adaptation, it's a bigger structural challenge.
I agree. And I think the events of the novella essentially take place over one day, really. You get like the contemporary narrative of current events from both perspectives of this newlywed couple. And it's, you know, just the evening of their honeymoon. And everything else is like a flashback or a flash forward, like a memory kind of sparked by something at the dinner table or whatever, which again is slightly harder to do in that very gesturing way in a movie, because you have to either be like, okay, we're committing to like a little flashback now, or you have to do some sort of internal narration. And I think it's related to another problem of adapting a book like this, which is that this is a book that's very much about internal monologues, and it's about the gap between what people are thinking and what they're saying. And you get a narration of, you know, someone thinking I love you and not saying it, you know, and what happens in between that space, and how you get to feel something but not express it, or you know, say something you don't feel. And that's really tricky to do on film, because even with the most skillful actors in the world, you can't literally communicate something unspoken if it's anything complex. So you know, and they don't go for a cheesy voiceover in this film, really, which I'm pleased about, but it does mean that there's a, I think it's harder to understand the motives of the characters in this film. You don't understand why they end up at this loggerheads where they can't meet in the middle at all. It's harder to understand how they got to that point, I think.
Yeah, and I think in the book, for me, is a lot more about class and about how that informs the fact that Edward is from this sort of working class family. His mum has some mental illness issues after having been had an accident with a train, and so he's always like slightly struggled with like pity and shame around that. And you know, he's gone to UCL, he hasn't gone to Oxbridge, and he's very, very proud of the fact that he got a first and all of this. Whereas Florence is from, I think, aren't her parents Oxford Dons? She's gone to Oxford, she's lived a really privileged life, she wants to be a classical musician. And the whole point of the novel for me was the fact that they were both equally unprepared from those two different walks of life for what marriage would mean. But also they found it really difficult to find common ground in their lack of knowledge, because they came from it from two totally different places. And I don't know whether the film dwelt enough on their differences for that to really come across. And overall, I was really looking forward to this film because I like the book, and I find Ian McEwan's work generally has worked really well on screen. Like Atonement, I think, is a triumph of a film. Of course, starring a younger Saoirse Ronan in one of her first major parts. But this really didn't work for me.
Yeah, it didn't work for me either. And there were there were like specific moments that failed in like a very literal way for me. So, for example, in the book, you can read a passage that's like, oh, Edward started kissing her and Florence wanted it to end. She was so stressed. She hated it. Everything about it was disgusting to her. She wanted it to end, but she didn't know how to say that. So instead she said, oh, shall we move to the bed? And like, you're like, okay, fine, I understand how we got from A to B here. Whereas in the film, when she's like cringing a bit in the kiss, but you can't really tell if it's like a good kiss or a bad kiss because he's enjoying it. And then she's suddenly like, let's move to the bed. I think if I hadn't read the book, I'd be a bit like, hang on, I don't understand what's happening here or why. Yeah. And maybe that's a valid way to feel, you know, just as valid a way to feel, because that's probably how it feels for Edward in that moment. He's like, what the hell is going on? Don't really understand. But yes, so things like that failed for me. And then just as a larger project, I just didn't really understand what it was trying to achieve, whereas I felt like the book was so good in giving you a young woman's interiority. I thought it was just like a great success based off that alone. And you don't get that so much in the film. So I struggled with what it was for.
No, exactly. And also one of my big problems with it is the decision that they would keep the same actors and just use prosthetics and makeup to show them aging, because it does flash forward, as you say, like you see what happens, you know, after the disastrous wedding night, right up to, I think, is it 25 or even 30 years later? It's just impossible to concentrate on how you're supposed to be feeling in what's meant to be a very moving scene when Saoirse Ronan is wearing like a full old lady's face.
Yeah, it's so bad. It's like the worst kind. And also they don't have the right physicality. And it's like, it's not fair to actually ask people that young to try and play that old. Do you know what I mean? No, it's just, it doesn't work.
If you feel that you have to show the forward flashes in detail,
recast
then you do what you do. They did in Atonement, where, you know, Saoirse played young Bryony. I can't remember who played
Vanessa Redgrave
played old Bryony, and then there was someone else in the middle. Was it Romola Garai?
That sounds about like the of person, but I don't know.
Yeah, I think it was her. Yeah, so Vanessa Redgrave was obviously perfect as, because, and I remember thinking when I saw Atonement how well that worked, because they'd given her the same haircut that Saoirse Ronan had aged like 10 or something. So you really felt like you could see the little girl that she'd become. But obviously she's a great actress and she has all of the mannerisms associated with her actual age. Whereas this just, it got almost a bit pantomime.
It was really panto, really, really silly. And also the film would have worked, I think, so much better had they not even bothered to then explore that. Because you don't really need to know what happens after the, as long as you know that, you know, spoiler alert, it ruins their relationship. As long as you understand that it ruins their relationship for life, you don't need to see what became of them. I don't think that's really a necessary part of the story. I also just feel like I really struggled. I'm not going to articulate myself super well on this, but I felt they played up of something that's very, very slight in the novel. There's like one sentence that suggests that Florence was maybe abused by her father, but it's very, very vague. And I kind of struggle with the idea that in order for Florence to be a young newlywed in 1960 whatever and have, you know, an extreme shame and or fear of sex, or just to be repulsed and to not want to have sex, I kind of struggle with the idea that as an audience we need like a reason. We need to be like, oh, she's frigid because of the sexual assault she experienced as a child, and that, and like, obviously that doesn't mean that I want to see less women who've experienced sexual assault on screen necessarily. It just felt like a kind of cheap little, like, I just don't think we needed it. Like, you can wonder as an audience, you can wonder like, oh, maybe she had a traumatic experience, as probably the vast majority of women did.
Maybe she had multiple, many traumatic experiences, as lots of women still do. And it informed her attitude to sex. Yeah, it felt way too glib and easy. Like, especially because I that annoyed me so much that I actually went and like looked for what Ian McEwan had said about this. And I found an interview where he said that in earlier drafts of the book, he did have the assault thing more explicitly. But then by the end, he decided that he didn't want it to be such a neat and obvious parallel. And he there was a quote in an interview where he said something like, it's there for some people if that's how they read it, but other people won't notice it at all.
And that's what I like about
it,
because I think you can just be a person in the world and be freaked out in sexual experiences, like, obviously, especially if it's like your wedding night and you've never had sex before and it's meant to be the rest of your life and it's meant to be like incredible. Like, there are so many reasons why that sexual encounter has so much pressure on it and could so easily all go wrong. And yeah, I just felt it like it was a little bit like pathologizing and a little bit like, oh yeah, of course, she's not like a normal woman because she's afraid of sex. She's like a woman who's experienced a huge trauma.
Also, I felt it did a disservice to Samuel West, who is an actor I like a lot, who plays her father.
So horrible.
And he was made so horrible, and most of his horribleness was cited in his moustache.
Yeah, that's true.
I felt like they gave him the moustache of a sexual predator, which I don't think was
Caroline,
very nice of them.
Spot on. So true.
But anyway, I did just want to say that I do think it is possible to do stories like this about longing and like internal, external differences well, because we have one in the form of The Remains of the Day.
Yeah, that's true.
That is, I think, the complete antithesis to this, in that it's about a maybe relationship between two people, one of whom is very repressed for reasons that we never really get into or know. And you can absolutely see on Anthony Hopkins's face what he is thinking versus what he's saying.
And like Moonlight.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have films that do this functionally and well. This is just not one of those films.
Yeah, sorry.
So last week, Caroline, or well, 2 weeks ago, if we're being honest with ourselves, but at some point in time, Caroline suggested that I watch Kate and Leopold, a rom-com starring Meg Ryan and Hugh Jackman. I really loved, by the way, that if you Google this movie and the Wikipedia pulls a description, they're like, Kate, Meg Ryan, working woman, New York, blah, 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 blah. She then meets Leopold, an 1800s, and like they don't do brackets Hugh Jackman. So in my mind, Leopold's just a real man from the 1800s that they like brought in for this film. So the premise is just as ridiculous as it sounds. We kind of open with this guy, Stuart, who is Kate's fairly recently ex-boyfriend, just stumbling across a route into the past, as you do. And he ends up in, what year are we talking?
It's meant to be the 1860s, I think.
Okay. So
I'm not exactly sure, but it's like latter part of the 19th century.
Yeah. And he stumbles into some kind of like on the street debate of things. And sees Leopold on the street, goes back. Leopold basically escapes back into the future with him, ends up at Stuart's place. Kate, desperately trying to get hold of Stuart, also ends up back there. And it's just like the three of them plus Stuart's massive dog. And then, you know, meet cute occurs, rom-com begins. It's a hilarious premise.
It is, yeah, and it is totally ridiculous, but for some reason I really, really like this film.
Yeah,
I think it's really charming. And I first watched it when I was like up at university, when most other people weren't, for some like thesis research thing or something. So I like didn't have any friends to hang out with, and there was nothing to do apart from go to the library. And I still had one of those. Did you ever have a Love Film subscription where they like send you discs?
Wasn't
in the
that
post?
What Netflix was to begin with?
Yeah, so there was a UK one called Love Film. And you just, I think I even had it set up where you added a load of movies that you were vaguely interested in seeing, and then it would send you either those
what
films
was available
or ones that were a bit like it.
Yeah, it's like, we didn't have this in your size, so here's a random rom-com.
Yeah, because I'd definitely never heard of this film before, so I hadn't added it to the queue, but it just randomly turned up in the post, and I watched it and I was like, this is the best thing
I think
ever.
It's like a guilty pleasure amongst a lot of women our age, maybe, who like saw it in their actually, weirdly, what it reminded me of is one of my favourite films, and I don't know if it was just the presence of the big dog, but it reminded me of the John Hughes 101 Dalmatians movie from like 92 or something, I don't even know, which is like just a silly rom-commy version of the 101 Dalmatians story that's kind of a bit more about Roger and Anita, and it's really nice, and it's got obviously Glenn Close as Cruella de Vil. So it is a kids movie, and there's Kate and Leopold, I think maybe it could be described as a kids movie. Like,
yeah, I think so. It has a set piece in Central Park where he like chases a mugger on a horse.
Yeah.
You know, it's got some sort of like mild peril action as well as...
There's like a whole scene where he refuses to pick up a piece of poo. Like, that's the level that we're at. And you can't, because of that, you can't hate it. It's kind of like charming, despite it's like... I think if we sat down and discussed this seriously, as we want to do on this podcast, we would probably talk about how it's a pretty conservative plot, right?
Oh God, so much so. And it also, I rewatched it, having not seen it for a couple of years, I rewatched it before we recorded this. And there are some like disturbing themes that I wasn't really aware of
yeah,
a few years
exactly.
ago. First is like how So it's amusing how Bradley Whitford's character, who plays Kate's boss, is sort of, he is responsible for like all the ills of capitalism.
Mm.
Leopold at one point calls him a serpent or something.
Yeah.
So he's the devil. And that, but that gets tied in with the fact that there's a kind of overtone of like Kate works and she shouldn't work.
Absolutely. And they play it off as a kind of funny joke. Like the part of the unlikely coupledom aspect is that Leopold's very like, research, that might be a suitable job for a woman, in fact. And she's like, what are you talking about? She's a career woman, you know. But that's undermined by the final happy ever after ending, which is, I mean, what happens basically is that she accepts a serious promotion at work, and then like mid speech, as we all do our like acceptance speeches for our promotions, she you know, realizes that actually this doesn't make her happy, and what would make her happy is going to 1860 with Leopold and
living a life of aristocratic leisure.
Yeah, it's a bit
wearing a corset,
an anti-feminist message, if we're being honest, isn't it?
Totally. So yeah, there's that part of it, but then there's also the whole middle of the film is sort of this one weekend where they sort of do things at Leopold's pace, because he finds the modern world very like confusing and frenetic. So they, you know, just go for like walks in the park and like wander around the city and have a nice time, and obviously all things that people in the present day do all of the time and enjoy. But the film frames it as like, and indeed Kate even has a line where she says like, oh, it's been just like, you know, must be like what your life is like in the 1860s this weekend, it's been so nice, want to do more of that. It's like, you can do those things with your current life, with all of the convenience of like good sanitation.
Please,
and
Kate,
political
don't
liberation.
Don't give up your sanitary products.
I know. So that never bothered me before, but now I couldn't help but think that like, well, I don't understand why the past is better. Obviously, there's all of the extra baggage when you talk about time travel in pop culture, that obviously it's fine because she's like a privileged white woman in New York, you know. People of colour, not so into time travel for obvious reasons.
Yeah, so. But it's still like totally baffling. And they never give you enough. Like, sure, she has a nice time with Leopold, but they never give you enough motivation for her to give up her entire life in modern society and go to the 1860s.
You could also, I choose not to interpret it like this because I think Hugh Jackman is generally a good thing.
Mm.
But, and so therefore I'm well disposed towards his characters, but you definitely could interpret it as like the film plays it as if Leopold is this like extraordinary romancer who just sweeps her off her feet. Whereas actually he just treats her with basic decency.
Yeah.
You know, like he's just attentive and it makes plans for her and doesn't expect her to do any of the emotional labor, you know?
But he like fundamentally doesn't understand her on a lot of levels and never can, because he's from a different time period.
But it just makes you... What the implication is that like every other person Kate has ever dated
could never possibly treat her with basic respect,
has been a total scumbag.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's horrible. This woman has basically been like gaslighted her whole life.
Yeah.
And then this one like vaguely courteous person turns up. She's like, yeah, sure, I'll move to the past with you. Sorry, I'm now trashing one of my own favorite movies. But anyway, all of this re-emerged as I was re-watching it.
Yeah. And like, you can't not enjoy watching the film, I think. It's, you know, it's got enough there to make it just like a beautifully enjoyable watching experience, even as you're screaming at it in frustration. It's the kind of film that you would recommend like getting people around and having some popcorn and like giving your own sarcastic commentary to. 100%.
Yes, absolutely. And I also highly recommend it. I think you said initially when I recommended this to you that you were going to watch it like with a huge bowl of pasta, like on a rainy evening. It's that kind of film,
exactly.
I think. So for next week, we are going to have a go at another podcast, which is something we haven't done for a while.
No, and I've been really hungry for a true crime podcast of late, so I'm hoping this is going to fill that gap.
Well, so I write so much about podcasts these days, and I've written so much about like the bad ethics of true crime podcasts that I've basically stopped listening to them because I can't
endorse it.
Well, I can't hear them without thinking of all of the like, even if the one that I happen to be listening to isn't doing any of the bad things, I've just like got a complex about this now, but this is why it's good that I'm going to do this. So we're going to listen to West Cork, which is an Audible original true crime podcast. I don't really know much more about it other than that it's had some really positive reviews and it is set in Ireland.
Cool. Well, I'm excited. Thanks so much for digging out of the recommends. I'm thrilled to be doing it. Thanks for listening to this episode of Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
If you enjoyed the show, why not subscribe to make sure you never miss another episode? We're available in all the usual places you get podcasts, including on Apple Podcasts, where you could leave us a rating and a review if you fancy. It makes us happy and it also helps other people find the show.
If you'd like to come and see us in person, check out the events page of our website, seriouslypod.com/events. Details of our next pop culture quiz and anything else we're doing will appear there.
We're available many other places on the internet, including on Twitter, Facebook and Tumblr. We're Seriously Pod on all of them. Follow us to keep up with what we're up to or to chat to other listeners about things you've enjoyed on the show.
We love getting your recommendations for things we should feature on the show or hearing your thoughts on what we've already discussed. Get in touch on social media or email us on seriouslypod@gmail.com.
And if you feel strongly that more pop culture needs to be taken seriously, spread the word and tell your friends and family about the podcast.